This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Pete Kunze. My guest today is Sabrina Mittermeier, the editor of Fan Phenomena, Disney. The book was published by Intellect Books in 2022. Hi, Sabrina. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. I'm glad for the opportunity to talk to you about this exciting new volume. Can you tell us a bit about your own background and training?
Yes. So I have a PhD in American cultural history from the university, the Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich, Germany. So most of my work comes from American studies, but since American studies is very interdisciplinary anyway, what that means to me is I do cultural history, but cultural studies sort of a wild mixture of all of these things, so whatever interests me. And I've been focusing basically all of my career, if you want to call it that, on popular culture and coming at it from sort of different angles.
And in particular, obviously, in this volume, you're interested in fan practices and fandom. So what drew you to that?
So I wrote my dissertation, which is now a monograph, on the cultural history of Disneyland. And the hurdle you always come across is that you have no clue what to do with, like, audiences, like the visitors of the theme parks. They're notoriously hard to study, because to really study them, what you would have to do is like big surveys or, you know, that kind of studies that are basically impossible to do as one person. You can never grasp them, but I think fan studies has, found ways to sort of work around that kind of methodology to study fans or study audiences. And so with Disney, that it was so clear that that's such a big part of what makes Disney Disney. And so it was kind of surprising that there wasn't more work on Disney fans yet. And I mean, it's sort of now is the moment when a lot of work in Disney generally, but also Disney fans is coming out. So it feels like a really good moment to do this. And it should have been done much earlier, but this is where we are. So,
well, I'd love for you to develop that a bit further. What do you see fandom studies doing for Disney studies? What do you see as maybe a gap in previous Disney scholarship, or let's say a misunderstanding among or incompleteness in earlier Disney scholarship that fan studies really helps to complicate and enrich?
I think Disney studies is sort of notorious for, like, early Disney studies, I'm talking like 80s, 90s, is notorious for kind of you know, talking about it as this like cultural imperialist empire. And I mean, they're not wrong about the Walt Disney Company being a cultural imperialist and playing a role in that, but I think it's sort of reductive towards, you know, looking at especially casting, you know, the fans or even like casual viewers or visitors of the parks or the films as, you know, sort of dupes that fall for like being brainwashed by the industry, by particularly Disney. So I think fan studies kind of brings more nuance to all of this, because a lot of fans are very active and are like in how they engage with texts. I think this is, I mean, this is what fan studies is based on, studying a lot of the direct engagement fans have with texts. That means they often produce their own art in some ways, or they engage, they can be engaging very critically with the text they're receiving. I think this is a nuance that that nobody in early Disney studies was actually looking at. So I think it's just, you know, highlights how much more complex all of this really is. I mean, that goes for all of pop culture, but for whatever reason, Disney was always sort of the bogeyman, as you know, in the culture industry.
Probably because it went after. Well, it addresses children, right? And we have to protect the children. So these presumptions of the dangerousness.
And then all the like never dying rumors about Walt Disney being like an outright fascist, being an anti-Semite, being, you know, whatever he was. I'm not saying he was perfect. He was definitely a racist. So many studio executives were and are like, that's not news, but I think it's also a reductive viewing of a very complicated person and a complicated company. So
yeah, and one of the things I think this volume does is think about, with these histories of imperialism, racism, sexism, homophobia in Disney culture, the ways that fans from those communities have nevertheless engaged in very active and nuanced ways with the content. And I think that that's something that a lot of the readers will benefit from in reading your volume. I wanted to now invert that question. What do you see a focus on Disney doing for fandom studies? What does studying Disney in particular allow fan scholars to ask, research, and understand better?
I think especially sort of that weird moment of like, this has been, the company is so notoriously like conservative in so many of its outlooks, and yet so many of the fans of it, very active, very engaged fans of it, are queer, for instance. Like, that's a cliche at this point, but it's also very true. Like, the stereotypical, especially white gay male Disney fan, but it's also a lot of people of color, like, that are, you know, big fans of the company, and they still, you know obviously about all the problems with racism. They know about the problems with homophobia. And I think especially in the last few years, there's been a lot of critical engagement and also discussion, I think, between fans and the company, because we're now at a point with, like, I mean, it's such a trite argument, but like with social media, with the way people engage with the industry more directly, that they had, like, the company has also started to listen to fans, or at least try to gauge better what like fans like and what they don't like, and that's also something that the book at least tries to pick up on in some of the chapters.
Yeah, that was something that struck me, and it was actually my next question. I think you kind of hit upon it, but I dabble in literary studies still, and I find that the people who are interested in fandom and literature sometimes go back to Jenkins, but of course Jenkins is one of the foundational figures in fan studies, and the field has evolved in many ways since textual poachers, you know, with and against Jenkins's ideas, right? And so I think that was something that came through nicely in your volume, was this kind of sense of where is fan studies at today, not only in terms of diversity, but in kind of complicating this notion of the fan as kind of a liberatory position or as a resistant position, right? Thinking through the complicated interchanges that take place between industry and individuals.
Yeah, and I think there's an interesting aspect with Disney now too, that there's, and I mean, it's not just Disney, but like this idea of anti-fandom, and this idea of like, fans aren't just like the resistance figures either. There's also like a lot of right-wing conservative backlash against, like, this is the weird thing, that there's like all these liberal or progressive, or whatever you want to call them, Disney fans that try to push the company towards the left and like improve representation. And then there's like a whole bunch of Disney fans who are like right-wing conservatives or worse, like, you know, outright alt-right, you know, figures. And there's that weird point of tension that I think is also not unique to Disney, but it's where a lot of discussion around these topics has taken place because of like, you know, mostly recent events like Don't Say Gay and that whole debate that Disney was directly involved in because of where they are in Florida and you know, and then also beyond that with their filmic output and so on and so forth. So I think it's just, yeah, it's a really good moment to think about all of these things with this company.
Yeah, one of the things I learned in reading your book is that inclusion has been added as a Disney value in recent years. And from a political perspective, of course, that's exciting for those of us who want a more progressive, inclusive, diverse culture and society. But of course, it's also a business practice for Disney, right? It's about making sure that not only people, but customers don't feel excluded. So can you talk a little bit more about inclusion's role in contemporary Disney and other factors that you see inflecting contemporary fan practices with Disney?
Yeah, I think so. Inclusion, as you already said, is a company practice. I think it was about time that they made it that. It's also not like a coincidental moment because they did this after like Black Lives Matter. I mean, Black Lives Matter has a longer history, but like that sort of boiling point in 2020. And I think it's become such an established business practice to say, oh, we're inclusive, we're diverse, like for all kinds of Fortune 500 companies. And it makes sense for Disney to obviously jump on that and say, we do this. I mean, for their own employees' sakes, to be honest too, because I mean, there's also been pushback from employees to some of the stuff with Don't Say Gay and other stuff that the company has been doing. But also in terms of fandom. I think they always try to walk such a fine line between like not offending anyone and always being, you know, appealing to everyone, which is always, you know, it's impossible to appeal to everyone. And I think that's always what the company is trying to do. And I think you can see that in fan engagement in so many ways. And like what we can do with fan studies with that, I think is sort of push the holes in that logic of like, we're going to appeal to everyone because you won't appease everyone all the time. And sometimes when they try, they actually make things worse or they kind of stagnate. I mean, I don't know if this is going too far off track right now, but I think what's also interesting is like we're doing this book between 2020 and now, and like a lot of the stuff that's been happened with Bob J. Peck as the CEO, who's also been, I mean, maybe perhaps unrightfully so, but like, you know, everything that's gone wrong with Disney has been put on him, but now Bob Iger is back. And I think there's so much happening internally with the company that some of the stuff we're probably addressing in this work is already maybe shifting again, or is in flux certainly. And I think there's also an interesting tension, like to look at it from like an industry point of view or like industry studies point of view of like what are the shifts within a company based on who the CEO is and what their stance, even personal stance, is on issues like inclusion and diversity, particularly on Don't Say Gay, Iger and JPEG did fundamentally not agree, for instance. So what does this do? And I think those are all things like, and how will they engage with fans? I think the two of them have very different ways of engaging with fans. So I think that's also something to not lose track of, and maybe not something that's necessarily part of fan studies all that much. Not to be too critical of colleagues, I think there's such a wide variety of people who do fan studies. I don't want to place judgment where that's not necessary.
I mean, it's clearly something that's changing quite a bit, right? When we think about someone like Iger, who at one point I believe was considering a run on the Democratic ticket. Yeah, for president.
I think he's right? Still going to do that, to be honest. Like his current tenure with the company will run out in, 2024. I think he's back now for 2 years. I'm not surprised if that happens to be when he decides to run for president. I mean, so many things will change, but he's been talking about this for way too long.
Yeah, it's a fascinating intersection of government politics, corporate businesses, yeah. And well, I guess corporate business is redundant, but corporations and culture, right? And yeah. The fans are right at the center of it. And in some ways, Chapek was reticent, if not inert, about questions of social justice in ways that Iger seems to have been much more open. Dare I say, even liberal. Some of the ways I've heard him talk about it, although there's always that reminder of like, well, he's speaking as a businessman who realizes the commercial value of doing, of being more inclusive.
I think that's also like some of the nuance has to come with all of this, is because just like fans are very nuanced sometimes in how they view something. They can love something to pieces and still see its flaws. Someone like Iger is still a person who has his own personal political beliefs and is apparently a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat. He comes from, you know, he comes from more liberal circles, and that probably won't not ever change, whereas JPEG is a lifelong Republican and comes from like Silicon Valley. So, you know, like all of these things matter in the end, at the end of the day. So, just ignoring that part of the company is you know, as flawed as ignoring the fans of the company and all of those. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the problems Disney studies have had, is that it's been very myopic. And something like fan studies can just, you know, break that open.
Absolutely. So I wanted to ask you too about the Disney adult, which was a term that seemed to circulate quite a bit in the discourse last year. And I feel like I can't let you escape an interview without us examining the Disney adult. I mean, why do you think the Disney adult is so vexing for non-Disney fans?
The good thing is several media outlets have asked me the same question. I think the term is interesting because it hadn't been quite, like, at least to me, and I mean, I'm online all the time, like I'm painfully online, and I didn't see it used as much before, I think, even 2021, maybe 2020 is when it started to come up. And so my thesis about this has been that it became sort of a term, like, you know, the idea that Disney adult is always means it's someone who's completely obsessed with Disney, is completely uncritical of it, and is embarrassing themselves because they as an adult like things that are quote unquote for kids, or they like them to an obsessive degree, especially also the parks, that they're also annoying even to some of the other fans, right? So it's this like extreme version of Disney fandom that goes to the nth degree, and then it exploded with this, like, I think Emma the Asshole Reddit post, you know, where people put their, like, you know, usually social situations, often relationship situations, asking people if they're the asshole, and they usually are. And it was about a couple who had a Disney wedding, and because it's so expensive, they didn't provide food for their guests, but instead spent the money on having Mickey and Minnie Mouse appear as characters in the ceremony. I don't know if it's been debunked now, because it also sounded like a made up thing, because I think how Disney weddings work is you buy a certain package, and it would be completely weird for there to not be food, you know what I mean? So I don't know, but this is how this got big, and then suddenly a lot of media outlets latched onto it, and there was a bigger discussion of Disney adults. But my thesis was like, why did this become such a thing aside of this Reddit post even, was that I think in 2020, when the parks had shut down because of the pandemic and then reopened very quickly, at least in Florida, because it was possible there, I think people kept obviously going back to the parks. And I think that also drew a lot of like ire from other people of like, how can you still go to the parks when this pandemic is spreading, when this virus is killing people? And also, how can you go to the parks when a company has just let off thousands and thousands and thousands of cast members and is treating them badly? I think the people really like saw again that Disney is a company and they let go people, and they have a lot of seasonal workers that they underpay. And I think that was a focal point. And yet there were so many adamant Disney fans who were still going and still pretending none of this was happening, I think. And I think this is where all the criticism comes from, and rightfully so. But Yeah, so the Disney adult, I think, is like the most extreme version of Disney fan. And there's some people that should be rightfully criticized because a lot of the Disney adults, like, I think that's what mostly is meant by them, like that example of the Disney wedding, whether it happened or not, is that idea of like, these are clearly very privileged people, usually with a lot of money, usually white, who have a lot of spare money to spend on like Disney merchandise and stuff like this, and are just incredibly entitled. And this is also why they usually annoy other fans. We don't have a chapter on the Disney adult in the volume. I think that's that because that wave of like discussing that term happened after we were already like going to print, or like around that moment where we were already in final stages of editing. But yeah, I think that's going to be, I'm not like, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of like fan studies articles come out in the next couple of years to deal with the Disney adult as a term.
Sure. And I believe that's something you say in your introduction, right? Like this is an invitation to a conversation. It's not the end of it. So I have a dissertation advisor kind of question for you, but I think it might benefit some of our listeners who are early career scholars. How do we study Disney fandom? Like, what are some of the methods that were employed in this book? And what kinds of approaches did you find the contributors wanting to take and employing in their studies?
I think some of the most obvious ways of studying fans, which is also why it's happening the way it's happening, is that a lot of fandom happens online. So especially when it comes to studying like fan art or fan fiction, I mean, that's all online. That's all freely accessible to everyone who has access to the internet. So like you can go on Tumblr, you can go on, you know, archive of our own and just, you know, see people's work and directly see fan engagement. And yeah, I mean, the study of fan fiction is, I think, where it mostly all started, like, because fan fiction was published obviously even long before the internet and fanzines. And I mean, that's still one of the most common ways of doing fan studies, is studying fan fiction and trying to make sense of what kind of fan fiction is being written and why and how and so on. Same with that of fan art, especially when it comes to diversity. That's often sometimes, you know, one of the most interesting ways of looking at race, for instance, because there's almost like race bending in art, and what does that mean, and what does it mean when white people do this, and so on and so forth. And then obviously social media engagement, I think, is a big factor in how people study all of this. And especially also with like anti-fandom stuff, because, you know, go into the comment section, like go on Twitter or go into the comment section of articles and you will have it all there. And I mean, I think what's was kind of missing, and not just from Disney fan studies, one thing that is not done enough yet is going into archives for that kind of thing. I do know a lot of people who study early fandom for things like Star Trek and so on and so forth. And I think that might also happen with Disney at some point, or we should try to make that happen with Disney, because actually fan production of Disney stuff might be more easily accessible than the actual Disney stuff. As every Disney scholar knows that has tried to find Disney archival resources. Because I mean, Disney fandom has existed as long as the company has existed, which is a whole 100 years now. So that's that. But I think the fact that so much of the fandom happens online and is easily accessible to everyone makes it also a cool thing for people who do undergrad thesis and so on and so forth, because they don't need to have, you know, fancy archival access or get travel money for it.
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways into these questions. And I think one of the things that comes through in your book is you kind of offer us these three sections and an interlude that think about kind of not only facets of Disney fandom, but questions that one might pursue. And in the first section, you're examining, you and your co-contributors are examining diversity in the Disney princess. So can you give us kind of an overview of that kind of conversation in Disney studies and some of the questions and concerns that come up in thinking about the Disney princesses in particular?
I think the Disney princess is probably the most studied aspect of Disney, at least from a like cultural media studies point of view. or gender studies, quite obviously. That's at least the stuff that I've seen. Like my first big international conference was PCA in 2016. And I remember there were surprising amount of people doing other stuff on Disney too, but the Disney princess on these conference programs, even now, is something that you see a lot. So I think that doesn't mean that it's been studied to death. I think there's a lot still to be said about it, also because there's more movies coming out, right? Or Disney has rebranded as a franchise quite a while ago. And so there's always new things to say about it. But I think in this book now, I think that's where we are with Disney Princess Studies. There's engagement with issues of race. There's engagement with issues of, as I mentioned, race bending and fan art, for instance. What does that mean? Also things from the parks come into play, because the Disney princesses are obviously also characters you can meet in the parks. So it's, I think we've moved to that sort of aspect of Disney princesses. And there's also other engagement with it as a veritable franchise, and how it is marketed to women of all ages, or marketed to mothers and daughters, for instance. So these are the kind of questions that I think are still very pertinent, and that's why they're in the book.
Yeah, I think, I believe I read an article a few years ago in Forbes that said the Disney princesses as a franchise are actually out earning Star Wars and Marvel, even though we think of them as maybe more visible or more profitable or more popular. It's still young children who want the Disney princess sheets and t-shirts and backpacks, and are going to see the movies that are spending far more money than the Marvel fans.
Yeah, and I think the misconception also is, oh, the Star Wars and the Marvel is for the boys and the Disney princess is for the girls. And I mean, outside of the gender binary being a problem, it's also a problem to think of it like that, because there's so many female Star Wars and Marvel fans, but there's also a bunch of boys who are like Disney princesses. And I think Frozen has shown that quite clearly as well.
Well, as someone of the generation that Aladdin was targeting, I can attest that I was more of a Beauty and the Beast fan, but we'll save that for another podcast. So then you offer an interlude on representation, censorship, and Disney Plus, featuring your own contribution. Can you tell us more about this side of business studies?
So my own contribution deals with exactly that problem of what do we do as queer people who like Disney when the company doesn't always like us back, or has a very complicated relationship with us. I mean, that's mostly in there because that's the thing I wanted to say at that moment in time, and it's very short. But I think that was just sort of this is what we're discussing most adamantly now. It was also the height of the Don't Say Gay debate when I wrote this. But I think that's one of the most clear points of we need to, for conversation in the future, this is where I want more people to do research on. And I know people are doing research on it right now, the issue of Disney and queer representation and queer fandom. Not that that's entirely new. There is already a great book by Sean Griffin out as well, but it's so many years old. So I think this is always the thing with it's not been done, because Disney is constantly changing and constantly evolving. So you can write an article on this every 5 years and you will have so many more things to say. And the other chapter that's in that section actually deals with Hamilton, the musical, and Disney, because it's obviously the live recording of it was put on Disney Plus, and has to do with a longer work relationship between Lin-Manuel Miranda and Disney. And so it mostly deals with things like what happens when this goes on Disney. There's two cases of the F-word being cut from the broadcast, things like that. So it was just a really interesting sort of little outlook into what do these kind of business relationships actually do to Disney, and how do you expand Disney, as well, how we think of Disney. And I think you think Disney when you hear Hamilton, but at the same time, and actually this is how you can consume that now, unless you can go to a live performance of it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, if we could return to your piece for a second, I was thinking as I was reading it, you have this kind of great call out of this kind of publicity of the first gay representation, right? And how it kind of comes up in Marvel or it comes up in Pixar. And yet, you know, for folks who know Sean Griffin's work or for other queer fans, right, they probably raised an eyebrow when LeFou was called the first gay representation because, you know, because of perception practices, we see something like, you know, what Ursula meant to many young queer viewers, or, you know, these kinds of relationships that young girls may have had with the Disney princesses that were not necessarily identification, but may have been more amorous, right? This notion of intention versus consumption becomes complicated, right? Because there were a series of pieces in the media where queer viewers were saying, like, we've always seen this as queer. And in fact, when you do the history, you see that there were queer creators behind the scenes who were bringing kind of camp aesthetic or maybe in jokes that would kind of intentionally and unintentionally kind of signal to those viewers what these texts meant or how they could be read.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, like, this is also part of, like, what my second monograph is going to be in, like, 5+ years time, but, like, that engagement with, you know, queer coding and the practice of queer coding that obviously originates with, like, the years of the Hays Code and, you know, outright censorship of, like, when you couldn't do explicit queer content because you couldn't get it past the censors, so you had to find other ways to put things in that were then part of the movie. And, like, you know, Vito Russo's work on this, like the Celluloid Closet, where he kind of unearthed things that are essentially queer coded texts. And that kind of constant tension, also, like, there's so many people who are, like, adamant about, like, it has to be explicit queer representation for this to matter. And I agree with it to a certain degree, because obviously in terms of industry practices, yes, because you know, it does actually sell, and people need to understand it sells, and it's the only way you're ever going to change any of these studios to make this, and then also then maybe cast queer actors and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, there's a great book by Melanie Conan where she argues, oh, you know, but queer coding still has value, like, there's still nuances to things, and that still matters. Like, it doesn't mean that it's, you know, just bad. Like, the queer coding in Disney, as you said, like, sort of infamous, it's a lot of villains, and everyone is like, oh, of course the villains are gay coded or queer coded, and it's like, yes, but because the animator was gay, you know, like, is what does that do? Like, does it make that automatically bad because someone was trying to, you know, impart something of his own into the work? And there's obviously, you're the expert of that, but, like, Howard Ashman writing so much stuff that's sort of infused with queer sensibility for mostly female characters. And you know, what does that do? So I think that's the, you know, all of these concepts, and there's the obviously the opposite concept of like queer baiting, when then companies realize, oh, it sells, but we still don't want to give it to you, which is where you end up with like Disney's first gay character, because they have sold the first gay character about 10 times now, without ever actually contributing, doing anything meaningful with it necessarily, I think. I like LeFou in the live action, but like he was already gay before we knew. Like did we need to confirm it? I like to see it confirmed, but at the same time, like it's not super integral to the story either. And I think I haven't seen, what is it, like Strange New Worlds? I'm saying title of the Star Trek show instead, but like the new Disney film that they didn't market and it's now very successful in Disney Plus, apparently as a gay character that's much more fleshed out and sort of integral to the story. And so yeah, I think that's also going to be interesting, how that's going to develop down the line, where the lesbian character in Buzz in Lightyear that was cut before Pixar employees were like, they cut that, they made us cut that. And I think that's a very interesting discussion too about like artists and companies really.
In the next section of the volume, you move into talking about the theme parks, which is an area that you have studied at great length and made significant contributions to. And of course, the theme parks are not just Disney World and Disneyland, but you know there are hosts in France and in Japan and two in China, well, Hong Kong and in Shanghai, right? How does this enrich our understanding of Disney fans to move not just to consider not only the relationship with, let's say, traditional legacy media texts, but to consider the theme parks? Although, of course, I think we can argue the theme parks are media too.
Yeah, I think for me, and obviously that's my bias, but I think the theme parks are some of the most interesting sites when it comes to fandom, because it's constant engagement with these parks and constant, you know, engagement with company practices. Like there's a price hike or there's a change to how you can park hop, so go between the parks when you have a certain ticket, or you know, and it's every little decision that the company makes is debated on social media every day. And I don't think that happens to that like small degree with the films. Like it's just, you know, it's because people feel very close to these spaces. A lot of the people who live close to any of the parks, you know, they're usually annual pass holders. They sometimes go there multiple times a week. And then obviously through that, they also engage with the films, because the films have representations in the parks through rides or parades or shows or whatever, or character meets. But I think it's such a rich area of fan studies because of that, because it's just, you know, this constant engagement. And this is also where I think the company has to listen much more closely to its customers, because with films, you know, you make a film several years, you put it out, you get a box office, you maybe now put it on streaming. So they have, like, I think streaming, I don't know if that makes it easier for them to measure, obviously. Yes, but I think that's also sort of obfuscated in so many ways. Like, what is the success of it's on streaming? How do I know if it's just a kid watching the same film over and over and over again? You know, all of these things. But I think with the parks, they very clearly get feedback immediately, and they've had to walk back some things because it was so unpopular. The Walt Disney Company just put out two massive shows in Walt Disney World, like one of the nighttime spectaculars 2 years ago, and replaced them again with the shows they had before because they were so unpopular. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you see that happen, because once a film is done, it's done. Which ironic is also what Disney liked about the parks, that you could always mess with them and do changes. But I think it's the same for the fans.
I was thinking as I was reading that section and learning more about things like Disney bounding, right? You know, on the one hand, Disney has this investment in inclusion. On the other hand, the parks are expensive. You know, as a working class kid growing up in the United States, like our family did the pilgrimage to Disney World once. And I got the impression at the time that my parents kind of felt like we have to do this to be good, you know, good parents, to take our kids to Disney World. And like, in some ways we were kind of over it, because I think I was already 12 or 13. And, you know, it was really, really expensive. And, you know, when I was reading the scholarship on theme parks, you know, part of the argument that gets made, as you know, is, you know, when you pay or set a price on those theme parks, and of course, the price of the theme parks famously jumped in the 80s and the 90s compared to where it had been proportionally before. It's not just about letting people in, it's also about keeping people out. So this is a very long way of me asking, how does the theme parks kind of stage this notion of who gets to be a Disney fan and the appropriate ways of being a Disney fan?
Yeah, I think that's sort of the core question, which is also why it became a core question for my first monograph about like class being a central factor in access to Disney parks from the beginning, actually, even though you're right, like the sort of, you know, who can afford to go definitely changed over the 80s and 90s, which also has to do with how this US society or the global financial market changed. Mm-hmm. They stage so much of it as inclusion and letting people in, and obviously the body of people who go to the parks has diversified because the American middle and upper class has diversified in terms of race or in terms of sexuality and gender. But on the other hand, like as you said, like some people can maybe afford to go once in their lives, but the people who go all the time, they have money, and that's just something that's sort of, you know, brushed aside. I think Disney knows, but they're still trying to sell it as a, they're sometimes still trying to sell it as an everyman experience, although I would also argue that they've stepped away from that. They don't even care that much anymore. They've started to cater a lot more obviously to a VIP crowd as well, but also to people who can afford things. And obviously when you take that to other countries, that varies slightly, but on the whole, they are like, those are expensive vacations. And for many people, it's a once in a lifetime thing. In some of the international parks, maybe you go for a day, but that's still an expensive. It's a bit easier, I think, than for instance, Florida, of course. But yeah, it's become sort of a boutique experience in so many ways. And I think this is also the audience the company caters to. So when they talk about inclusion, that's usually a factor that they don't want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. And as we move into the final section of the book, the focus shifts to how fan labor gets monetized by the company. And if I remember correctly, the whole Disney Princesses phenomenon as a franchise in the company is fairly recent, right? It only happens about 15 years ago. And I think Andy Mooney, who was responsible for it, says that he was at some kind of Disney event, maybe he was at the parks, and he saw little girls in makeshift princess costumes, and he was like, why aren't we producing princess costumes, right? And it's like the company sees what young girls are doing, and it shapes business practices, right? It shapes, like, we should be catering to what fans are doing on their own, catering being a nice way of saying, you know, exploiting, formalizing, monetizing. So this is another long way of asking, what do you mean by fan labor for those who aren't in fan studies? And how has Disney in recent times been engaging with fan labor and even exploiting fan labor?
Yeah, I think fan labor for me encompasses everything that, you know, fans produce. And they obviously produce that for their own joy or for their friends and other fans' joy. But you know, that's fan fiction, as I said, that's fan art, that's also cosplay. So a lot of people make their own costumes. Some people even make their own toys, you know, like customized Funkos, you know, that kind of thing. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of labor actually happening from fans, fan videos, all of this stuff. And obviously, yeah, the company starts to notice, and not just Disney, but like Disney also especially starts to notice things like you said, like, oh, you know, apparently people like to dress up as characters. Why are we not selling them the costumes to do so? And maybe not just for Halloween. So yeah, they started selling Disney princess dresses in the parks, but also with Disney bounding, which, you know, is a form of Disney specific cosplay, because the parks have a policy that as an adult, you're not allowed to dress up in full costume when you're in the park. But so you won't get confused with, you know, the actual Disney characters. Mm-hmm. And And that's been sort of interesting how the company has also started to circumvent their own rules to monetize on people obviously wanting to do that. So if you go to a Disney Parks Halloween party, you're allowed to dress up, even though there's also tons of characters in the parks. Or now with like Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, the company is selling fairly high-end cosplay to you. Like they're selling really cool like Star Wars costumes and props to you, but then you're not allowed to wear them in the parks. And I've been waiting for them to kind of loosen this rule with the things they're actually putting out, because it's kind of silly. This is where you want to wear them. You want to wear your costume in Star Wars Galaxy's Edge and then take pictures and put them on social media. So I don't know what's going to happen with that. And but also they've opened this like crazy expensive boutique experience hotel of the Galactic Star Cruiser, where I think they're trying to do this for like people who can't afford to, for several $1,000s a day or night. You can do a full-on role-playing experience in the Galactic Star Cruiser, and I'm pretty sure most people buy the costumes before they do this if they don't already have cosplay. And yeah, Disney bounding exists because you then like this is to circumvent the rule as well. That just means you sort of dress in like normal, quote unquote, street clothes, but that sort of have like the color scheme of a specific character. And people do this, and I think Disney knows about this now. So they're now selling merchandise that's specifically geared at Disney bounders. So they know that. And this is sort of the process of all of these things keep happening, you know, like fans do something, they produce their own stuff for it, or maybe third-party companies are starting to produce stuff and are starting to make money, and then Disney's like, wait, why are we not doing this? And sometimes they're quite good at it, and sometimes they suck. Sometimes they put out horrendous merchandise that, you know, if they had ever talked to fans about it, we would have told them. This does work. And I think they need to actually almost get better at that. I think they need to start hiring more people who were first adamant fans. I think they would actually make a lot more money if they did that, but we'll see.
Yeah. And this whole idea of posting on social media, right, speaks to the way that fans become uncompensated promoters, right?
Yeah.
And I think this comes through nicely in the interviews you included with actual Disney fan influencers or prominent Disney fans. Can you talk about the decision to include that and what you feel that adds to the volume?
So it, you know, the decision to include it basically comes from the fact that the book series, this is a part of just this lot. So they do usually like highlight fan practitioners in the series. So I was like, that makes sense. And so the people I chose to interview also, it was very, you know, I wanted to interview people that weren't just white, heterosexual, cisgender people. Like a lot of blonde women do a lot of Disney influencing. Like that wasn't the, you know, target demographic that I thought had interesting things to say about what it's like to be a Disney fan right now. And so I interviewed Victoria Wade, who's a Black queer young Disney influencer. And she does a lot of cosplay. She does a lot of Disney bounding. She's also worked for the parks before that. So a lot of people who end up being Disney influencers, fans are CMs, so cast members of the past. So I think there's like a multitude of, you know, different perspectives, and obviously also the racism you endure as a person of color that's a Disney influencer, and how that differs, you know, from a white person doing this. And so I think it's just interesting perspectives from people who are also not like, you know, also academics. I mean, I think most of the scholars who wrote for this volume would also call themselves Disney fans, but then we already have that filter built in of like, this is how I see this now through this lens of having done fan studies or cultural studies or whatever for a long time. But if you talk to someone who's an influencer who also doesn't write scholarly articles on their own practice, I think that's a different point of view, just clearly. So yeah, it was a way of like engaging with important issues like systemic racism in the fandom, but also a way of just getting a different perspective.
Excellent, excellent. As we head into the home stretch, I wanted to ask you, what do you see as the future or futures of Disney fan studies? What kind of work do you see coming out of this volume? What kind of work would you like to see that you're not seeing yet or not seeing enough of?
Yeah, as I said, more engagement, I think, with queer fans and sort of the complicated relationship, because what's there is good, but it's like there's so much stuff happening. But I also know that there's stuff coming out on this. So that's sort of a spoiler. I know people are working on, on that topic. But I think also there's been a lot more engagement with Disney parks in the last few years. And I see a lot more of that happening. I mean, the people who contributed to this volume keep writing their own books and keep publishing articles on it. So I know there will be more of this, but I also see people who aren't in the book do this right now, because it's, again, it's such a rich area of fan studies and it's so underexplored still, and there's so much you can write about. So I very much expect that. The other thing, as I said, would love to see is more like historical engagement with Disney fandom and people who try to dig into the archives and, I don't know, write on all the Mickey Mouse merchandise from the 30s and how fan engagement with that worked. Right? I mean, I think that one of the only things I know that does this kind of stuff is maybe for like the Crockett craze in the 50s, like the Davy Crockett that was so popular. But at the same time, I don't think there's like a full engagement with that yet either. And how like, you know, the boomer kids basically engage with all of this, and that's fan studies. So I think that would be really cool to sort of have that more historical perspective on it, which was also the only criticism I got in the review reports. It wasn't much of a criticism. It was just someone saying, and actually I could probably reveal this, was John Will saying, hey, why don't we have more historical outlooks, which is not surprising because both of us come from like cultural history and American studies points of views, but I totally agree. Like this is a gap in this book, but it's also a gap in the overall research.
Yeah, and it's a hard nut to crack too, right? I mean, how do we kind of get into those historical practices that may not necessarily have been archived in the way that other aspects of Disney culture were archived. But it also opens up to new methods, right? Like oral histories and...
There's a whole generation of like even older baby boomers who still go to the parks, who still go to events like D23 Expo, who, you know, I've met and become friends with, who sit in homes full of Disney memorabilia. So I think this is now the moment where you should talk to these people, because a lot of them will unfortunately die or you know, become maybe, you know, get dementia and you can't interview them anymore, any of the usual problems you have with doing oral history. So I think actually, if you want to look into Disney fandom of the like 50s or even earlier, you need to do it now.
Yeah, absolutely. So my final question for you is the general softball we always throw at the end, which is, you know, what are you currently working on? And, you know, are you doing future research on, further research on Disney fan practices, or is your attention currently elsewhere?
My attention is sort of elsewhere. I mean, I will probably never stop doing Disney studies, because that's just what I, you know, what people ask me about, what the media wants me to talk to. But, and I run the Disney studies area at PCA every year, so that won't stop hopefully for a bit, because we only started it last year. But generally, so I'm supposed to write a second monograph, and I want to write it on the idea of unmade queer television. So there's a few people who do unmade studies, you're one of them. So looking at not produced, not produced media, mostly to television, film, so scripts that weren't filmed for whatever reason, or cuts. It's like I see it as a broader thing of like a larger issue of censorship, especially when it comes to queerness. And I look at it for the US and Germany. I just haven't really progressed with this project for several reasons, one of them being too many other things. And now that I finally have more time, because I've wrapped up so many of these other things, I've been on sick leave for a whole semester, so that's been stalling that. But that's the thing I hope to get back into, and I'm excited because I get to do a lot of cool archival research at places like the Writers Guild Foundation and so on and so forth. So that's what I'm doing. There's also still a volume coming out, but that's almost wrapped up. We're just waiting for review reports and hope they're good to us on the musical history of New York City. That I interviewed Anthony Rapp for. So
here, out there,
and like Rent or Star Trek Discovery. And yeah, other than that, I really should be writing the second book, but yeah. And I will probably start blogging about TV now to get back into writing, and then mostly like my obsession of Ted Lasso. So.
Well, we wish you all the best, and hopefully when in due time, when the volume's done, you'll come on and talk about it again.
Sure.
So thank you so much for your time today, Sabrina. The book is Fan Phenomena, Disney, available now from Intellect Books. This is Pete Kunze, and this has been New Books in Film on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time.